Well, now, I guess In Search of J.D. Salinger did not turn out the kind of book that you expected, did it?
No, not at all, in lots of ways. Although, oddly, the new version, which is in effect the third version, is closer to the kind of book I had in mind when I first thought of doing a book about Salinger. And when I had it in mind then that the biographer should be a kind of character in his own biography, or in the biography he was writing, and that his he probably wouldn't find out very much about this invisible man, but that he would have lots of interesting adventures on the way, and in the course of narrating these adventures, various questions about biography, about the propriety of biography, about what it ought to be and how far it ought to go and so on, especially in relation to a living person, would be raised. But of course then I actually found these letters, and that changed the picture altogether. I began to find out more than I thought I'd find.
Well, let's work our way up to that. Incidentally, a biography of this type is not unusual. Are you familiar with a book called The Drumlin Woodchuck?
Exactly,
by
yes.
Mark Harris?
Somebody was asking me this morning whether I could remember another book like this, and that came to mind, which I'd semi-forgotten, I mean, but I remember, yes. I mean, there is different, because Bello was, theoretically, had given him permission to research, and then once he started researching, I think he then started to try and thwart him at every turn.
And Bello did meet with Mark Harris on a number of occasions, and Bello is accessible. I've interviewed him myself, not at any depth, but he was simply elusive enough that the story of that quest was not unlike your own.
Mm.
Well, let's go back. First of all, now you are an Englishman, and Salinger, of course, is inherently American. Why did you become interested in Salinger?
Well, I suppose one would have to go back to age 16, reading The Catcher in the Rye and falling in love with it, along with several million other adolescents. And certainly for a few years, it was, two or three years between the age of 16 to 19. This was my sort of key book, a kind of talisman almost. And then I sort of forgot about it, and then my son came to be 16 in the fullness of time, and not a great reader in those days, and came home from school one day saying he'd read this wonderful book, and I said, oh, yeah, what? Expecting it to be, Stephen King or something, but he said it's The Catcher in the Rye. And I'd sort of forgotten about The Catcher in the Rye. I mean, it hadn't been much part of my sort of life or thinking for years. And I was struck by the fact that it still had this force. It was still speaking to adolescents in a quite sort of different adolescent culture almost. You know, when I read it, there weren't any teen heroes. You know, it was all sort of pre that pop music thing and so on. Anyway, I was struck by this, and then my son said, well, who is J.D. Salinger? And I'm rather afraid that's what started the whole thing. This came at a point when I'd just published a biography of Robert Lowell, and was sort of casting around. People were asking me what I was going to do, and so on. And so this idea sort of evolved.
Well, you seem to pick a tough subject. But you're absolutely right. Did you use the term talisman a moment ago?
Yes.
Yes. And indeed, in my late teens, maybe early 20s, I discovered The Catcher in the Rye, and I still have my dog-eared paperback copy that I've carried around with me for something like 30 years. And the book, in fact, I believe, is the only book that my son has ever read in his life, and he's 19. He doesn't read, but that book did mean something to him. And even this poor, demented kid from Hawaii who murdered John Lennon, he carried this book. I think one of the reasons that the book did become a talisman for so many people is that, well, the language seemed to be so like our own at that time. And apparently it still is. If people are still reading it and young people are still hypnotized by this book, apparently Salinger was able to capture that original voice that few people can do in print. Is that? Would you agree to that?
Well, I think it is a wonderful, sustained act of mimicry, really. And of course, for an English reader, it had a special sort of exotic flavour, because this wasn't our colloquial speech, but it was this racier, tougher American speech that seemed so sort of strange and exciting and so on. Yes, I'm sure that's one of the reasons for its appeal. I think another reason is it sort of combines a kind of moral certainty with emotional confusion, and this is wonderful for an adolescent to sort of have it recognized, have his emotional confusions recognized, but also to have attributed to him a kind of moral certainty that he knows and can tell on his pulses what's right and what's wrong.
Did you know when you undertook this project that Salinger had become a recluse?
Oh, yes, I sort of vaguely knew what everybody knew, that he'd stopped publishing and he'd refused to see anybody, refused to do all the things that sort of most writers agree to do, like give interviews and so on. Yeah, I knew that. I hadn't really thought much about it, except to feel sort of rather sad that there wasn't, it seemed, going to be any more books by J.D. Salinger. And although I must say that I am not a great admirer of his very last books that were published, but
Of his what?
Of his the very last pieces of by Salinger that
Franny and Zooey and
I like Franny and Zooey, but I don't much like the Seymour introduction, and the very last story that appeared in the New Yorker seemed to me to carry that whole sort of narcissistic enclosed family glass saga sort of really to the to an almost unreadable kind of point.
When you decided to do Salinger, you wrote him a letter, is that correct?
Yeah.
How did you know where to write?
I wrote to him, I think, care of his agent, I think. He's in Who's Who's, and that address was always given, and I think that's how I wrote to him.
But you could probably just write to the post office there in that. What's the name of the town?
Cornish.
New Hampshire.
New Hampshire,
yeah. I understand. I think I've read that he goes into the post office to get his mail occasionally. Is that correct?
I'm surprised he still does, because that's where everybody seems to have waylaid him whenever he has been waylaid.
Well, he responded to your letter. What did he say?
Well, he didn't at first respond. I mean, at first there was a sort of silence, which was more or less what I expected, because I'd been told, because I'd started asking around by this stage, and I'd been told that he didn't reply to letters and so on, and not to expect a reply. And so I sort of started off, I set my biographer to work, as it were, by sending off a kind of form letter to all the Salingers in the New York telephone book, really to get them to say where the name Salinger had come from, what the genealogy was, and so on. And by chance, Salinger's sister and his son have New York addresses and are in the New York telephone directory. So unknown to me, I'd written to his son and to his sister. And it was this that sort of triggered the response, I think. So this was some 6 months after I'd actually written to him. I then did get a letter, more or less sort of implying that I'd been harassing his family, which of course wasn't the case. I mean, it wasn't knowingly the case anyway. And saying, you know, he wished I wouldn't do this and so on. And he didn't, he wanted to be left alone. He'd had as much intrusion on his privacy as he could bear, etc., etc. And, I mean, it was a fairly strong letter, but rather sort of over-elegantly written, I thought. I mean, really. but it did give me pause and made me sort of wonder whether I ought just to call this whole thing off. But then I thought, well, that's what I expected anyway. I mean, I didn't expect him to sort of write back and say, wonderful, come and see me, we'll talk, and so on. So I somehow incorporated that rebuff into the biographer's adventure story, as it were. This was stage one, you know, sort of contact had been made, sort of thing.
Now, obviously, you had to come to the United States to do this research, didn't you? And it would be rather difficult to do this from England, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, most of it was done here, yes. Yeah. In fact, all of it, I think. All of the research.
Mm-hmm. So what happened? You had the rebuff from Salinger. You decided to proceed.
I wrote back to Salinger and said I could see, you know, his point and so on, and that I hadn't knowingly written to harassed his family, and certainly wouldn't do so, and that he needn't sort of fear that this was going to interfere with his life at all, because I intended to limit my research to the years in which he'd actually been publishing. That's to say 1930 to 1965, when he stopped. And that I would stop then, when he stopped, that when he withdrew from the public domain, I would acknowledge his right to be left alone. And this seemed to me to be legitimate. And I also undertook to sort of, you know, tread as carefully as I possibly could, that it would be a sort of literary, biographical undertaking, and not a sort of gossipy biographical undertaking. And that I didn't think on the whole he need have any fears and or worries, and that I even was so bold as to hope that he might like my book when it was completed.
Was there something in the back of your mind that Salinger might have made himself available for an interview with you?
No, I think in my original sort of synopsis for the book, as it was sort of presented to the publisher in the end, it was, the idea was that if this biographer were sort of at large, as it were, going around sort of asking questions and looking up things in libraries and so on, and Salinger was aware of his presence, that there might be some way in which he would respond to that activity, even sort of mischievously, because there have been examples of Salinger sort of giving out misleading and mischievous sort of pieces of information about his life and so on, as if he was prepared at any rate to engage in a sort of cat and mouse game with people like me and so on. And so I did rather think that that might happen. I mean, I overrated the mischievous element, I should say, as it transpired.
How did you develop a list of people who knew Salinger, so that you did interview a number of people in preparation for this book?
Yes, I interviewed a certain number of people. I mean, a lot of people didn't want to be interviewed. I mean, one was I did know, and I was told the names of people who were friendly with Salinger. I mean, that was fairly sort of common knowledge. It had been written about and so on. People like Peter De Vries and the writer William Maxwell and New Yorker figures as well. I knew the editor of the New Yorker, William Shawn, I knew to be a close friend of his and so on. So I wrote to these people, I mean, not really, again, expecting for them to cooperate, but to see what they would say, to see how they would phrase their refusal. I mean, this was just something that the biographer had to do. So, sure enough, I mean, they did write back and say, sort of with a rather regretful tone in one or two cases, that they couldn't cooperate and that they had undertaken not to in the past, and they didn't see any reason why they should alter their attitude. And it was quite impressive. I mean, that sort of inner circle was sort of entirely impregnable. And
as you began to develop your research, you stumbled upon a cache of letters that gave you a lot of illumination about the personality and life of Salinger. Where were these letters?
Well, some of them were in Princeton, and they were letters that Salinger wrote to Whit Burnett, who was the editor of a magazine called Story Magazine back in the 30s, and who also taught a creative writing class at Columbia that Salinger attended. And Salinger's first story was published in Story Magazine, and so he engaged in this quite spirited conversation, correspondence with Burnett over a number of years, really for about 10 years. The files of the magazine are in Princeton, and I found these letters in the files of the Story magazine.
Available for anybody, any scholar, to read?
Yeah, sure. Yes. And have been there for some years.
You found other letters elsewhere?
And in Texas, there was a file of letters that he'd written to a woman called Elizabeth Murray, who was the older sister of a school friend of his. And it was a sort of non-romantic relationship, I think, between him and her, but fairly intimate. I mean, he did sort of write fairly intimately to her, and almost as the Burnett letters dried up, the Murray letters then sort of took over and covered the next sort of 10 years or so between sort of 1940 and 1950. And then the third lot of letters, which covered 1950 to 1960 something, were to his English publisher, Hamish Hamilton, and these weren't in libraries, but I simply wrote to them. And And they sort of sent me a package of his, well, told me to come and pick up a package of his letters.
These were the original letters?
And they were the originals, yeah. I mean, it was quite...
What did you do with these?
Well,
you had to give them back.
Oh, sure, yes. And, but I mean, I was so cavalier about it. I mean,
well, it seemed to me that would be a very valuable archive.
Well, I dare say, yes.
Although they didn't recognize it as such.
Yeah. I mean, they're letters that wouldn't, that are now, of course, available to the public because of the lawsuit in a way that they, of course, wouldn't have been before.
Mm-hmm. Now, how much light was shed on the life of Salinger in these letters?
Certainly from a sort of chronological point, from the point of view of constructing a chronology, from knowing where he was at any given point and more or less what he felt and so on, they were very illuminating. I mean, but how sort of beyond that they were illuminating, I would hesitate to say, because Salinger did write a very self-conscious letter. I mean, he wrote his letters with a certain amount of sort of artistry and self-conscious sort of skill and sort of. I mean, he wrote a very good letter, if you know what I mean.
But he didn't, in the vernacular, spill his guts in these letters.
No, I don't think so. Now and again, certainly during the war, when he was obviously having a very bad time, there is a more authentic sort of heartfelt note sort of does show itself from time to time. But in the main, there's such self-conscious performances and very entertaining performances that you don't really feel you're sort of getting the whole man at all, no.
Did you go up to New Hampshire?
No, I never did.
Did you want to get the lay of the land, see what is...
Well, because of my sort of... I'd set myself these boundaries, I mean, that I was going to stop in 65. Well, he had moved to Cornish in 53, I think. There was something to be said for going there. But there was also something to be said against going there, which was that there had been so many people that sort of hung about up there and gone up and tried to waylay him and get pictures of him and interviews, that it seemed to me important that I sort of didn't do that if I was going to be able to say later on that I had sort of stuck to my rules. So I became quite sort of almost superstitious about the need not to go there. In fact, after the book was done and after the lawsuit and everything was more or less over, I did pass near Cornish and went, and I think I stayed about 5 minutes in the town. I just sort of got out in case I bumped into it.
So you went back home to start work on the book. You had an advance from Random House for this, is that right?
Yeah.
Did you, were you contracted by an English publisher as well?
Yes.
Who was the initial publisher?
Random House.
Random House was the initial publisher.
Yes.
So you went back home, you put the biography together, you sent it to Random House, and everything looked good, right?
It looked fairly good, yes, yes. I mean, the book was a bit on the thin side.
On the thin side?
Yes, I mean, certainly in terms of information and so on. And because I'd found these letters and had enough to construct a conventional chronology and so on, I had abandoned the idea of sort of fictionalizing the biographer and making him a character, and all the original idea had been rather jettisoned, largely because I'd found out more than I'd expected to find out. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I hadn't found out enough to make it a really impressively rich conventional biography. I don't think I could say that.
So, Random House printed the galleys, sent them out. I guess you were stunned to find out that Salinger had gotten an injunction. It was an injunction, wasn't it?
Yes.
I'm not sure how the chronology worked here.
Well, he, yes.
Yeah, it was an injunction on October 3rd, 1986. You were still in England at this time?
Yes.
When you heard about this?
Yes.
What was your reaction?
Well, I was pretty surprised because the lawyers had gone through this book, as you can imagine, fairly carefully, and it had been decided that the amounts of quotation that I'd used from the letters were within the boundaries of fair use, this notion that you can fairly use some small part of an unpublished letter. So I thought, on the legal side, that all these precautions had been taken. So, yes, I mean, I was surprised.
So you rewrote it. You paraphrased from the letters instead. You sent the manuscript back to a Random House. Same thing happened, another injunction.
Yes.
What was your reaction that time?
Well, then I was getting a bit exasperated, I suppose, because already I thought that the book had been sort of fairly damaged by having to transcribe or reduce Salinger's sort of lively sort of letters into this rather trudging paraphrases that I had to compose. And so I felt that the book had been sort of diminished slightly, but I also felt that we'd gone to pretty extreme lengths to placate Salinger, and that his original point had been answered, you know, that his words were being appropriated. I didn't feel that this second version really did appropriate his words. But nonetheless, he persisted with the suit, and as you know, he eventually got a judgment in his favor.
Yes, it went to two appeals court, and the highest court and the Lamb refused to review it, the case. So here you're holding the manuscript that you can't publish. What did you do then?
Well, then we were waiting, really. There was a long gap between in which the application to the Supreme Court was being prepared and so on and so forth. A gap of some 6 to 9 months in which the thing was just sort of sitting there. And one day I just thought, well, what I might do is sort of assume that I'm not going to be able to use these letters, and just go back to what I'd originally intended to do, which was to, as I say, to fictionalise the biographer's adventures and so on, or semi-fictionalise them. So rather as an experiment almost, or rather than just leave it lying around, doing nothing while this case was being prepared, I did rewrite it, eliminating the letters altogether.
But you made reference to the letters.
I made reference to them, yes. I mean, I'd gathered from the judgments that had been made against the book that it was permissible to report on the factual contents of a letter and to characterize the tone in which the letter had been written and so on, but not to either use the exact words or to paraphrase them in a way that appropriated their spirit or essence. These are rather vague terms, but...
Would I have found out more about J.D. Salinger by reading your initial book than I have with In Search Of?
No.
No?
Would you have done?
Would I have found out more about Salinger in the original book?
Well, I think you would, in a sense that you'd have had a livelier, dramatic sense of him. I mean, his presence is there in these letters, and you get his voice, and you get his jokes, and so on, and so he's sort of exhibited in a way via his letters much more immediately than I am able to exhibit him in this book. In this book he is more sort of distant, and therefore I feel freer in a way to speculate about what he may or may not be like and so on than I felt in the first book, where one did actually have him in this very limited way on display. So, yes, I mean, that's a loss, really. Yeah.
But the facts of his life haven't changed, and that essential information about what is little is known about Salinger is still available. In this
yes,
book.
Sure, yes.
And it's incredible about what little is known. For example, you mentioned his first marriage to, a French woman. I think we only know her name. Nowhere can we find her. We don't know where to reach her. No details. Salinger remains, even though he's alive and we know where he lives, he remains a person of a mystery, doesn't he?
He does indeed, yes.
Why?
You mean why is
he? Yeah, why is he? Why is he a man of mystery? Why did he become this recluse? I mean, is he well? I mean, he came to New York and gave a deposition, and the transcripts show him seemingly to be lucid.
I think he's extremely lucid, yes. I don't think he's there's any element of insanity or irrationality.
He's certainly eccentric.
He's certainly eccentric, yeah. But I think, I mean, what I hope with this book is that his reclusiveness becomes more understandable, although I don't set out to try and explain it or give some sort of easy explanation for it. I think that, or I hope that a reader of this book will see that it's a possible next step for this man who has been sort of damaged in the nerves by his war experience, who's then taken up Eastern religion, who's uncomfortable with the fame that's suddenly sort of visited itself upon him and so on, and then who is the object of a lot of media attention and critical assault later in the day. And I think that these strands are all there, and it's not entirely surprising that he chooses to do what he does when he does it, and then it becomes a position that he hardens into, as it were.
What is your theory about why he is no longer publishing? He claims he's writing, but we don't know that for a fact.
We don't know it for a fact, but we're fairly certain that he is. I mean, he said it himself, and it's been said by others who are in a position to know that he has been writing all these years. And my understanding is that these are more glass stories, more stories about this glass family, which is the subject of his last two or three published books. And I think that the reaction to that his glass family stories, which was sort of almost contemptuous towards the end, pieces by Mary McCarthy and George Steiner and people, did wound him quite badly, but wounded him on their behalf, because he'd always, right from the beginning, taken this curiously proprietorial, almost parental view of his characters. So he would talk about Holden Caulfield as if he was a real other person whose views ought to be consulted on this, that, or the next thing. And I think that he began to sort of feel about these Glass family. I mean, this is partly what's wrong with them as fiction, that the author is too in love with his own characters, I think, but the fact that he is in love with them means that he wants to protect them. He doesn't see why he should expose them to this kind of hostile comment. And also I think he's genuinely thrown by a lot of public appraisals of his work, to the extent that he would find his work interrupted, and this is what he says, and I presume, I don't see any reason why we shouldn't believe it, that the kind of disturbances that are created for him psychologically by exposure to the public view have in the past, so he says, interrupted his work to a damaging extent. So the only way to really get into a piece of work and sustain it and concentrate on it is to cut that stuff out altogether. You know? Well, that's one theory.
Chris, his literary output is not very great for slim books. Not very much, is it?
No, I mean, there is a lot of uncollected early material, but which I don't suppose he would...
Yes, there was somebody published some of his early stories, I believe, pirated these stories, and I believe he sued to stop the distribution of that book. I don't know if he made reference to that.
Yes, I do make reference.
Can't remember that part. But I assume that he's able to finance his life through the royalties on Catcher in the Rye.
Yes, I think he says in his deposition that his royalties amount to $100,000 a year, but seems to me a modest reckoning. But and The Catcher in the Rye is said to sell 400,000 copies a year worldwide in paperback, and all his books are in print, and he's still a very popular writer, I mean, internationally.
What do you suppose is going to happen to his literary estate after his death?
Well, presumably he will leave some fairly clear instructions to his heirs about what he wants done. I mean, since he's been so exercised about it in his lifetime, presumably he'll be... except that in his lifetime is a phrase that he uses from time to time, meaning this lifetime, that because he does or seems to believe in a sort of Buddhist reincarnation and so on, so he might have arrangements for... coming back in a new guise and doing something about his own manuscripts himself, perhaps writing his own biography.
Wouldn't it be interesting if he had kept a diary over all these years, that when the time comes to go through his papers, that would be a guide to writing a full-fledged biography of all of them?
Well, I'm sure somebody will be in a position... I mean, at Salinger's death, various things will change. I mean, that people who don't feel able to speak about him now will be able to speak about him. And letters presumably will begin to sort of surface.
Well, Ian Hamilton, have you learned your lesson undertaking a biography of a living person?
I think I've learned my lesson, yes.
So what's your next project?
I'm not sure, but you can be absolutely certain that it won't be anybody who hasn't been sort of dead for at least 100 years.
Well, it doesn't have to be that long. But it is a sad thing, I think, for scholars that the courts ruled the way they did. I was absolutely stunned. This is a very strong First Amendment nation. I could see rulings like that perhaps coming down more easily in England, where The right of privacy and libel seems to be upheld a little more than it is here. Most rulings go on the side of the First Amendment in this country, and if these papers are available for anybody to read and pick up and look at and photocopy, it just baffles the mind as to why the courts rule that way. I think most of us agree that Salinger has a right to his privacy, and these shoddy sensationalist magazines, newspapers that go up there to try to photograph him and talk to him. And I mean, we think that's appalling. It just seems to me a very misguided decision on the part of these courts. But that's, I guess, water under the bridge, so to speak. But I thought it was a fascinating book. I knew so little about Salinger and a man who was so influential to me, and now I know a little more, thanks to In Search of A.G. Salinger. Ian Hamilton, thank you very much.
Thank you.